Hello, I'm Dr. Lou Condor, technical communicator, writer, editor, as well as adjunct lecturer at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Welcome to the podcast for the Advanced Technical Communication class, where we discuss key aspects of technical writing and communication. Welcome to week two of the Advanced Technical Communications course. This week I wanted to cover a number of things, and I just wanted to say it's nice to meet everybody. I really enjoyed reading the little snippets of biographies that people put in the forums. Thank you. So let's just dive right into this. I want to talk about what we cover in this course and some style guides and a few other things. So in this course, we cover a diverse group of projects and topics related to the core of technical communication. And we start off with kind of something simple in week two, which is tables. And those are very, very important. And a lot of times we have to represent data or money. So that's why I have you doing the money. It's a simple table, but it'll get you kind of warmed up. And feel free to Google that, look it up. Feel free to, you know, just sort of try something. I'll post a example at, you know, after everybody hands their work in, that what I think is a really good piece. So please just dive in. Don't worry about mistakes. You get full credit if you just do the work. So just try it. You know, this is the place to really try. And then know this, with technical writing, you have to redo documents a lot over and over again because things change, or, you know, everyone's getting on the same page. So don't feel bad. Redo it for your portfolio if you want something to look good. Just, you know, enjoy the class and learn. So we also break down documents and data to turn into information, which is like evaluation. You know, we look at them, we make sure that we're covering all the information. And that's, a lot of these things, if you'll notice, are intertwined. So we look at the document purpose and what is it used for? And this is usually a one sentence, maybe two sentence thing of exactly what, and you have to be clear and concise. And you'll hear me say that a lot in this course, but being clear and concise really, really matters. So style guides, we use them a lot in technical writing. You use, I've used MLA, which is basically more academic. In the real world, you use a lot of APA, which is the American Psychological Association. And I use Chicago Manual Style and AP. AP I've used a lot for blog writing. So it's just something to keep in mind. And we interview subject matter experts. We think about that. You have to go in there and talk to these people because you're not going to know everything. And that's not your job. Your job's to know the basics, and you have to figure out what questions to ask them. And we will go over that. Testing documents, strategies, and document scope. The single most important thing is document scope. What I mean by that is, what do you exactly include in the document? You don't want to include more, and you don't want to include less. Too little, and the reader won't get the information that they need. Too much, and you will confuse the user. So you don't want a lot of extra stuff. And, you know, this can be sometimes out of our hands. It can be controlled by certifications, you know, or just by what management wants, etc. So we'll talk a bit about that. And I really want to emphasize, I'll tell you exactly, but we want to create portfolio pieces here. In order to get a job as a technical writer or a technical communicator or anything under that auspice of writing, you need a portfolio. That's it. There's no other way around it. And if you don't have one, you're most likely not going to work as a technical writer. And don't worry about it. You know, at first it may not be the greatest portfolio. Who cares? You're going to work on it. You're going to get going. I mean, I look back, I keep my portfolio pieces over the years, at least one or two. And it's just, I look back and go, oh my goodness, you know, how they're not as great, you know, like it just, you just improve over time. So just let yourself have that, you know, and improve. And, we, you know, we'll talk about all kinds of things, and especially one of the big things are step-by-step instructions and blog posts. I know this sort of is strange, but step-by-step instructions are the bread and butter. You know, they're procedurals, and they're really the bread and butter of a tech writer. But more and more blog posts, technical blog posts, are becoming big because organizations know whether they're nonprofit, whether they're scientific, or just big business, they know they have to communicate out there with, and if you will call it, their constituents, as well as anyone who is in the field on what they're building, what they're creating, what they're researching. So that's a big deal. Now let's talk about style guides. Many publications, organizations use style guides. This is across the board. A style guide is a manual detailing the house style of a particular publisher or publication. There are already ones out there, like I mentioned, you know, the APA, which we'll learn in the class. We're not going to go too crazy. It's very, very deep. We are just skimming the surface. I want you to start getting used to, if you have to include a reference or if you pull information from somewhere, to include that, because that is very, very important. You know, in research, you have to always credit people who do the original work. And if you don't, then there's an issue. You know, it's plagiarism. But in big business, it can go deeper than that. It can actually cost money to a company. So you really want to make sure that you put that out there. And it's a type of template file consisting of font layout settings to give a standardized look to certain documents. We will talk about these templates later, but most everywhere you work will also have their own style guide. So their own style guide is the look and feel for the company. If you go and work, I've worked at Sony and General Electric, and I've worked at Edison. I've worked at all these different companies, and they have style guides. They have a certain look. Even if it's just like the background is white, the text is red, you have, you know, the logo at the top left, already they're dictating what it looks like, single column, etc. They all have them, basically, and you really need to follow them. You know, some of them are pretty common sense, like, you know, most body text is 12 point or 11 point, depending on the style of type, but you still have to follow them. Some commonly used guides are the APA, the Chicago Manual Style, Modern Language Association, which is the MLA, and honestly, the AP. You know, AP is not that crazy. And basically what I do is I have a Kindle and I buy all the electronic versions and I keep them on my Kindle because it's so easy to just like look up something. So you can go into the book and do a global search and you don't have to like be like looking in the index of a paper-bound book and have all these books on your desk. I mean, that's the way I do it. Makes me happy. I have some images of what these manuals currently look like, although they are changing because they're getting new versions all the time. Honestly, the new versions are very minor. Between APA 6 and 7, it's so minor that, you know, I wonder even sometimes really you're making money on this, because it's just, there's just minor changes. And I say to everyone, don't worry about it. Do APA 6 or 7 in the course. Some of the older textbooks are in 6. So, because they only just jumped to 7, just before COVID, barely before COVID. So I personally don't mind. Just know that there is a difference and it's very minor. So, very minor wording. The biggest changes in APA 7 are publisher location no longer needed. They used to go, you know, locate, you know, whatever in whatever, Idaho or something. And you don't need that anymore because everything's online and global. The in-text citation for works with 3 or more authors is now shortened from the first citation. You only need to include the first author's name and et al. Before it was like 7. So now it's much, much smaller, which is very nice. The DOIs are formatted as URLs. The label DOI is no longer necessary. That it's a type of index. URLs are no longer preceded by retrieved from, unless a retrieval date is needed. I still do it. It maybe it's a bad habit. I don't know. No one's called me on it. So, you know, and maybe people prefer it, but you don't really absolutely need it anymore. Web page titles are italicized. Ebooks, the format, platform, or device is no longer included. I'm not sure why they always included it in the past. Like, why does he have to know it's a Kindle, where they put it out as a what's called an EPUB format, which is readable by so many devices. A computer can read it, right? So it makes no sense to me. And you want to have bias-free wording, and there are font, running head, and heading level changes. We don't need to worry about those for this class. I'm not enforcing any of that. I'm really concerned with you thinking about your references and any, if you're citating or quoting anyone. This is especially true with numbers. You want to make sure you cite them, you know, where you got it from. Because if you say 80% of all Americans, you know, drink wine, that's just your opinion unless you've actually gotten it from a very specific study. A lot of times things like that can be found in the government. And, you know, legitimacy to a study matters on who does the study. So if the U.S. Department of Agriculture does a study, that holds like really high esteem. Anything that's peer-reviewed or reviewed by other people in the same field or government bodies has a lot more weight as far as legitimacy than just Wikipedia. And get used to not using Wikipedia, because that's not a real reference source. Sometimes it may be spot on, but a lot of times it's not. And there's no one overseeing that. So it's just random acts of you could add to Wikipedia. So I would not use that as a source. You need to be able to start the basics. Now you want to go, why do I need to create graphics? Well, you need the basics of graphics. Every tech writer does some graphics. Think about it, screen captures, those step-by-step procedures, you need pictures. So you need to do a screen capture and a call out. We'll talk about that later, but you really do need to do them. Tables, charts, you know, insert clip art, basic things. You can use whatever software you have. I have used everything across the board, including like on Windows, just, you know, the print screen and paste into like the free paint. It's called Paint program, the older one. I mean, whatever's got there. I mainly use Photoshop though. And I usually insist wherever I go that I have Adobe Creative Suite, because I need to be able to access all the different tools. This is being created on Adobe Audition alone. So, I mean, I use all the different tools in Adobe Suite. I highly recommend learning InDesign, Photoshop, and Illustrator so that you get those. InDesign is a layout program, and when you do monster manuals or certain things like real publication books, you really have to know it, because you have to be able to insert text. And there are, right now, we have LinkedIn Learning for free through the university. So go to your mycsudh.edu, log in there, and start taking advantage of that right away. You have two more classes. Go crazy. Learn as much as you can. It's free, because that stuff's expensive. Okay. Now, screen captures are totally necessary for step-by-step instructions, including standard operating procedures. Standard operating procedures is, in a weird way, another step-by-step instruction, because it's telling someone how to proceed at something that usually requires safety or some other corporate or organizational approval. And there's tons of freeware out there as well on the web, so I strongly suggest looking at that. All the software, like here I have a slide, a future tip on graphics. It's slide number 8. Considering software makes you employable, I'm telling you, the Adobe Suite will make you like very employable. I recommend, you know, Google's free, so you can learn the G Suite or the Google Suite. I mean, it's a really watered down version of Word, Excel. Yeah, I mean, they're not very good, but a lot of companies, smaller companies, use them because they can't afford to have the big Microsoft stuff, which is expensive. Microsoft is the number one thing I've ever used. When you go to big corporations, they always use it. And I'm a heavy user of Excel. I do pivot tables and stuff like that, because a lot of times you can embed that stuff right in. And I can tell you this, making changes is a lot easier than trying to do tables and then going back later and making sure that, you know, oh my gosh, how do I update this? And it's like a real pain. So for me, a lot of times I'll embed Excel spreadsheets inside of Word, and that helps me. The way I look at it is I learn anything that helps me, my life, make my life better and make things go quicker, tech writing. Because don't forget, as if you're ever a lone tech writer, which you will probably be a huge amount of your career, what goes on there is, or even if you're in tech and you're doing technical writing as part of your job, you know, you don't have time. You're working on multiple projects. And that's the thing that you have to know about tech writing is you will be working on multiple projects simultaneously. Other software is, like I said, Excel, Word, and PowerPoint. I do Visio. You do a lot of flow charts and things. I also was an engineer, so Visio and CAD are two things that I learned. I don't advertise CAD because I don't want to do it now. I can take the files and you can convert them over so that they work in any program, but I don't really want to do CAD drawings. I would get paid a lot more money, and that is just not my thing. Visio is great. It's super simple to learn. Learn content management system, at least one, such as an enterprise one, like ECM software and 365 is an example, but there are tons of them out there, and you can just Google that. Well, I highly recommend learning tools such as HTML5. You can do a lot of things are on the web now, and CSS, which are cascading style sheets, which control the look and feel of your site. So I like to do web. It makes me happy. I usually don't design the website. I just dive in and work on whatever client has. So that's sort of the way I approach it. I could design one. I've designed my own site, if you've seen it. I use templates and then I modify it. It's PHP. I've actually done programming. So if anybody has a question about doing API docs or something like that, we don't cover it in the courses because you really have to know a bit about programming, but I can sort of direct you in the right direction if you're interested. And but I just recommend, like, HTML is just a markup language. XML is another extensible markup language. That's what it stands for. XML, basically, you can write your own HTML is the way it looks like. It's great for, you know, doing basically moving data about, so you can pull data in from another source and then make it look good. I was also a SQL programmer in another lifetime. So SQL is a good one if you really want to get heady. You don't need it. I don't recommend it, but it will actually get you through the door. And here are some others. I mean, it's specialized, right? I have some specialized stuff. Git and GitHub, which is open source. It tracks your API documentation. You have DITA, which is Darwin Information Typing Architecture. Again, data manipulation. LaTeX or LaTeX. That is a markup language that scientists use. I learned that when I was at Caltech. You have, but I don't even remember it anymore. I don't really specialize in that. Any kind of dashboard style software, inline documentation, anything like that. It's all specialized. But if you're going to do that, you really need a basic understanding of how to code and how to program. Sorry, I took a drink. Podcasting, video, etc. This is where the creative suite comes in. I gotta tell you, I really like podcasting and I really like making videos and writing scripts. So if you like, and I'm talking technical scripts, either training, product introduction, product enhancements, or just how to use the product, right? Absolutely awesome. And you have, you know, in those realms, you have different levels of technical difficulty. You have the, you know, it depends on the product, but I worked in the process industry. You can have the basic stuff for like the techs, or you can have an engineer and you have to really show certain like tweaks, internal tweaks in a device meant for the oil and gas industry, which is different than that same device, which is used in, you know, water processing or something else. So it's just something to be, there's a whole field of that out there. And I usually get hired for that a lot because I also have entertainment industry experience. So graphic tip, I will post this link, but free high resolution images, totally royalty free, just free. at unsplash.com. So it's UNSPLASH.com. You could just use that stuff. Use it in your portfolio. Make your stuff look fantastic. You know, don't make it look drab or whatever. Just, we get enough of that when we actually work on the jobs. So make your portfolio look great. They add nice value and they really give you eye bling, which, believe it or not, is what clients use, even though their stuff may be a little bit bland. Additional software to consider. It's a broad field, so there's so much stuff out there. And you can't know everything, so focus on what you want to learn. What industry do you want to work in? If out of all the Adobe products, if you only wanted to learn one, learn Photoshop. Now, I want you to like go to LinkedIn or Glassdoor or any one of those places. Look up tech writing jobs and say, where do you want to do? I mean, do you want to do documentation for gaming? I had students who did that and they created that stuff. Do you want to do it for programming? Do you want to do it for medical devices? A lot of times you can take what you've done before or your experience in the field or degree that you've gotten, and you can go in that direction. It's a great way to get started and then migrate away, but focus your portfolio on where you think you might want to go. I've seen, you know, everything from, in Culver City, Beats hires technical writers. I mean, because they do, you know, they do audio products. Apple hires tech writers by the dozen. Granted, you have to live in Cupertino. You know, some jobs you can easily work remote and some companies don't allow it. And I just find that that's each company. I've interviewed with NASA before. They're totally about half inside of, you know, the organization and working from home half the time. So there, it just depends on who you work for. I have some examples posted of technical writers. I think you should look at the slides. It's really neat and it just gives you an idea of what to think about. So what are portfolios basically? Let's get a little deeper into this. Portfolios are proof that you can do the job. A portfolio is a collection of your work and you want to demonstrate that you have mastered your craft and are capable and competent to perform a job that you are being hired for. You know, and so basically you're showing them, I can do a little graphics, I can do a little writing, I can write reports, because some jobs, I've had people call me in the financial industry and want me to work there as a tech writer, and the one thing that they were doing was designing forms. You know, they were using Acrobat, and your job 90% of the time was designing forms. And I've had other jobs, and they're online interactive forms. And then I've had other jobs where they're just talking about reports, you know, so you're going to help engineers write their reports for whatever they've done for the customer in chemical or environmental. My portfolio. So what should it consist of, rather? You want 10 to 15 pieces. Anything more than that is a little bit much unless they're different. If it's a different aspect of the field, I have a few more than that in mind. But to get started, just 10 to 15 pieces. What I do in mine is I have kind of two samples of a lot of the different work I've done. I've done a lot of different things and I can specialize. I specialize in policies and procedures. So I have, you know, two different examples of that. I have, you know, some, I separate things out, but I also have on my website, I have a table of contents. And so they click on it and they'll jump down. So I did anchor tags and linked it in. Like I said, knowing a little bit of HTML doesn't hurt. You can have a physical paper portfolio or you can have a digital one. Me, I switched over to digital about 10 years ago. And the reason is I can update it anytime I want. I can hide stuff I don't want a customer to see, you know, if I'm having one person look at it. I don't like to give people permanent copies of my portfolio so they can go and look at it online. I also take and I can cut them off. Like they get 2 weeks to look at my material and then I change the password. So I like that ability to control my work and so people can't necessarily take it off the web and claim it as their own. And people can't also do a lot of other things. If it's in public domain, like the Sony stuff, I don't really mind. It's public domain, so I just put it out there. Using fewer key pieces gives the interviewer more of an overview of your best work. Don't include something that isn't what you feel is your best work, and feel free to swap things out. It's better to have 9 pieces, portfolio pieces, that really rock than 10 with one bad one, you know? It's okay. Like I said, it's okay if you don't think it looks great when you first start. That's fine. You're just getting started. And so they'll actually kind of get that. If you do web documents, keep your site updated and have mock-ups of the site done in case those sites go offline. So I always have, you know, a collection of the material in case I get hacked. I mean, lately my site's been getting pounded. I do a lot of back-end work on it. Again, I was a computer engineer, so I can do that, but you can do some very basic stuff. Consider, you know, password protected area, and don't be surprised if potential employers ask for a piece of your work in the interview. The way I do interviews is I go in with a portfolio piece printed, and I always go in with a printed resume, because I can't tell you how many times people go, "Oh, I forgot," and then they're scrambling, and they don't care if they look bad. They just don't want you to look bad. So what I'm saying is you look like a hero if they say, "Wait, no problem. I have an extra 2 copies of my resume. Let's hand them out now. We can always do this later." And then they're like, "Wow." You know, they get like, "Wow, you're prepared." You know, so it's really a nice thing. What not to do. Don't take anything proprietary and show it without permission. You might inadvertently show something to a competitor, and believe me, the market's small and you can get into trouble. So don't take anything without permission to show. And it's really hard, but when you do software, I don't have a lot to show my thing because, you know, I did a lot in Sony and it was all proprietary and they're very, very particular. So it's just something to keep in mind. What I do is sometimes is I write other documents based on something else, just like the ones I did. So that there's no code or anything visible. Don't use the work of someone else as your own. It'll never work out well. And don't take full credit for a whole project if you worked in a group project. Tell them what you did on the project. And honestly, they want to hear group projects. A lot of times you won't work alone, but a group project means you can work with other people. And that's a real bonus, you know? So if you did the graphics or you did the layout or whatever, just let them know. You know, it's just a great thing. I take samples again with me when I go on a job interview, like 1 or 2, in case they can't get on. And you'd be surprised. I won't tell you which company, but it was a very major organization I went to interview with once. And it was their cybersecurity department. And they couldn't figure out how to log into my site, which is just put the password in. Like I emailed it to them. And the password, and all they had to do is paste it in. And I was just, it was like 10 minutes of trying to get them. And finally I said, "Would you mind if I did it?" And I got up and I did it for them. And they were always putting an extra space. So that just goes to show you, and these guys are not dumb. This is one of the most major organizations on the planet. And they couldn't put in the password right. So, and I said, you know, if anything, I'll just type it in for you. Mine are not overtly long. I mean, it's not like horribly long, but still. Have your references ready. I mean, have just one copy and you could just hand it to them and say, "Here are my references." 2 or 3 are fine. Some companies are ridiculous and they want 5 or 10, and I won't work with those people because I think right there, you don't know what you're doing. And that will mean my life will be awful. And you can't always choose. So it's up to you what you want to do, but I think 3 references are more than adequate. One big thing, be prepared to be tested on the spot. Sometimes all companies usually test for your writing. They'll have you write a piece. They'll have you do all these different things. And in the end, you know, it may be take home, but it might be you're timed right there to write something. So don't be surprised and just be prepared. Again, you want to present a portfolio that's grammatically correct, pleasant to look at, you know, accurate in whatever areas of information. So if you create a piece for your portfolio, just make sure it's spot on, you know, and that there's nothing glaring that do your research. Like, it can't be glaring misinformation. Contain clear and concise documents. For example, you don't want anti-vaxxing information inside your portfolio. No one will hire you. They'll just go, oh, okay. So you really want to be like, if you have that sort of philosophy, just avoid putting a piece like that in your portfolio, because you won't get hired and it does not look good. Contain, have clear, concise documents. You want them to be laid out nice. You want them to be written really well, very tight. You'll see it as we go along in the course. You want to follow very specific things as you write your documents. You want quality graphs and charts and presentations, etc. You don't want low resolution images that are chunky and chewy and very pixelated. Yeah, you don't want that. And try to go for 10 pieces. If you had 15, 18, that's fine. Focus on what you want to do. Highlight your knowledge and show you're an asset to your future employer. And customize tool that demonstrates what you've done in your potential. So right now I'm going to say, do you have any questions? You can just put them directly into online in the questions area or the open forum. You know, we can discuss this, but we'll have more of these to come. And that's it. Thanks. Music by Purple Planet Music at music://https://www.purple-planet.com.